From deep in the Swedish forest, the only individualist radio program in Europe, this is BSI Radio International. Beauty is a manifestation of secret natural laws, which otherwise would have been hidden from us forever. Revealing all to those who care to listen, this is the voice of the sovereign individual. My name is Paul Lambert. In modern scholarship, there is a distinct divide between the physical sciences and the humanities. There's a general sense that the physical sciences touch upon such things that can be rationally contemplated or observed, while the humanities are wholly within the province of feeling or whim. Physical sciences deal with such things that are independent of the arbitrariness of man, such as physics, biology, chemistry, astronomy, medicine, engineering, and other such fields which man masters through the use of empirical knowledge. The forces that govern them are there, whether man chooses to observe or discover them, or not. The humanities are, on the other hand, as the name suggests, the study of the human condition, and the methods of observation and analysis are highly speculative and critical. Humanities encompass such topics as languages, literature, history, religion, the many forms of art, including music and theatre, as well as many branches of philosophy. For the past several centuries, the natural sciences have been regarded as a so-called hard field of study, dealing with the objective, while the humanities have been seen as soft, with observations being open to interpretation. This has, in time, resulted in the well-deserved inferiority complex on the part of the humanities in relation to the physical sciences, especially in modern times and the age of relativism permeating our outlook on everything from morality to epistemology. At present, the physical sciences remain largely bound in reality, and it's expected and required that observations be interpreted in a manner consistent with all other observations, and that apparent contradictions cannot hold true, that men's theories must be modified as new information comes forward. This is not true of the humanities today. The wishy-washy relativism in observing the human conditions gives us, for instance, in the field of morality, the notion that there is a split between the practical and the moral, thus creating moral codes, such as altruism, which by their very design are impossible to practice. Relativism generates such bromides in the field of morality as one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. In the field of history, there's no longer a set of facts that lead to a conclusion of past events, but merely competing narratives. Thus, in the Arab-Israeli conflict, it is not a matter of one side or the other lying, but there is, on the one hand, apparently a Jewish narrative, and then on the other, an equally valid but competing Palestinian narrative, which is no less worthy of consideration. Even in the field of epistemology, postmodernism asserts not only that it is impossible to arrive at the truth, but that the very notion of there being an objective truth is erroneous. Thus, when two people interpret the same information or observation in different ways, it is not simply a matter of one of them being correct and the other mistaken, but rather that the first man's interpretation is true for him, and that the other man's interpretation is true for him. As yet, the physical sciences largely, but not completely, have been free of such irrationality. So it's easy to see why the physical sciences have been assigned to a much higher pedestal than the humanities have. Imagine if in mathematics we were told that one man's square root is another man's inverse cosine, or in medicine that there's no such thing as color blindness. Rather, the world truly is in color for some and equally truly in black and white for others. The futility of pursuing such fields of study would be apparent. Even in such humanities that still deal with irrational and consistent observations, such as my fields of study, classical history and archaeology, as well as languages such as Latin and Hebrew, the practical utility of devoting so much of my life to these pursuits are lost on many, especially those who see higher learning as a direct path to a handsome paycheck. That is not, or at least should not be, the purpose of entering into the humanities as a field of study. Thus, when a diesel mechanic asks me, what can I do with a degree in classical studies? He is asking what kind of jobs does a graduate in classics get. The question is improper relative to the implied desired answer. Just what do I do with classical education? Well, what do you do with a cricket bat or a baseball glove? What do you do with a frying pan or a lawnmower? What do you do with a snorkel or a hunting rifle? Arguably, some people do make money in using such things. However, there are far more people who own them that put them to a use for which they were designed without a thought of making a living with them. What do I do with a classical education? I can read Caesar, Cicero, Ovid, and Juvenal in the original language. I understand the roots of words in English and other modern languages, and I am able to use proper grammar in those languages and absorb such rules on an intuitive level, rules that seem perplexing to many. I'm able to observe events of the day and predict the outcomes of choices made by our leaders with uncanny precision, not from any gift of prophecy, but by noticing that there is nothing new under the sun, and that while history might not always repeat itself, it always rhymes. I understand where such things as manners and etiquette come from, and what purpose such rules serve. Far from being an arbitrary convention, I understand that manners are necessary to maintaining order in a free society. This is not immediately apparent to others who are not classicists. Furthermore, while certain political and cultural movements of today like to think of themselves as progressive, a classicist can recognize that they usually are not, rather they represent a huge step backward into the practices and moral codes of ages past, and the destruction they can cause. I also notice that those who would be labeled conservative often, but not always, represent a view that was indeed held by generations of the past, but that those particular generations were greater than we are, and then recognize the destructive trends and behaviors in their own time that resemble those promulgated by modern so-called progressive movements, and they worked to overcome them and take man to a higher level of civilization and consciousness. What I also understand as a classicist is that there was a time that there was no split between the humanities and the physical sciences. In ancient Rome, a well-rounded man was expected to have a command of knowledge extending across the entire spectrum of human experience. There was as much science to be mastered in a poem as in an aqueduct. Every effort put toward creating such had to keep certain rules of objective reality in mind in pursuing its purpose. Now, the body of knowledge of man has grown on an order of magnitude since that time, and it may well have been inevitable that there be a split between the physical sciences and the humanities. A child does not know how a motor car works. He simply sees and knows that it does. As he grows older, if he's like most of us, he will eventually come to have a fairly accurate, albeit imprecise, understanding of how a car engine works and how they work to move a car. Perhaps paradoxically, the physical sciences are more tangible than the humanities. Consider the broad field of aesthetics. Consider artistic depictions of any kind, be it music, dance, theater, painting, sculpture, or poetry. Like the child who knows that a motor car works, but not why, when it comes to artistic depictions, most of us simply know what we like and what we do not like, but we don't know why we like or dislike any aesthetic piece in particular. The aesthetic phenomena into which most of us come into contact on the radio is, of course, music. Music stimulates the brain, and different kinds of music and different songs within the same genre even will stimulate the brain in different ways in order to produce various emotional or intellectual effects. You can probably think about many songs or type of music that you don't like, and you might actually have asked yourself in the past how anyone could possibly like that music. However, it's important to remember that any particular piece of music, while self-contained, does serve a specific purpose, and not everyone is hoping to get the same thing out of the music to which he listens. We will delve a little more into this shortly, but firstly, we'll take a break for a musical interlude. As you listen, decide whether or not you like this song in particular, and why is it that you think you like it or dislike it. One of the earliest men to make a structured analysis of aesthetics was the Greek philosopher Aristotle. Aristotelian aesthetics generally holds that art should depict man as he can and ought to be. It was a sort of romantic realism long before that term was coined. Certainly, music theory has advanced greatly since Aristotle's time, but what we can deduce is that music should stimulate man's higher senses, and in Aristotle's view, listening to music should be a wholly uplifting experience. In music, a good song is formed by the clever combination of dissonance and resolution. What this means is, in relation to melody, that a dissonance occurs when there is a sound or a note played that is clearly not the bass key note or chord, known as the tonic, and thus leaves you with an unfinished or incomplete feeling. You sense that at least one more note needs to be played in order to finish off the section or to resolve it. Resolution is that sense of completeness, typically generated when a song melody ends off with a note in the tonic, or the chord progression sounds like it has come around again to the tonic. In the previous song, Classical Gas, there are many instances of dissonance and resolution nested within each other. This raises the dopamine levels in the brain, and we experience such music as either soothing or uplifting. On the opposite end are what I call the dunka-dunka three-chord types of songs that stimulate the reptilian brain and can almost be felt in the chest. A lot of dance music is based on this, and they tend to be easy to play and to memorize. Those people who prefer a large degree of dissonance and resolution tend to find such music repetitive and boring. But for other people, such is the value of music of this kind, and there are even those who cannot appreciate music that is compliant with the Aristotelian aesthetic. Well, here's an example of what I mean. Let's take a three-chord dunka-dunka song that was amazingly popular, and I will demonstrate what I mean. Listen for the chord progression. There must be hundreds of songs that sound like this. Alright, the song starts out with a few bars of the tonic, then a major fourth for two bars, and back to the tonic, major fifth, then a fourth, and back to the tonic. And so it repeats. There's a slightly different bridge for a couple of bars, but still the pattern of dissonance and resolution is exceedingly unsophisticated. Another example of such a three-chord song is this one. See if you can notice the same standard tonic, major fourth, and fifth pattern. Notice too that in the vocals there's very little melody. If transcribed to piano, the entire vocal part could be played using only three keys, and most often using the same repetitive pattern. Only slightly different is Proud Mary, also by Creedence Clearwater Revival. Notice that there's very little melody indeed, but rather an almost monotone chanting in the vocals. The dissonance, immediately toward the chorus, lasts for only two bars before the melody returns to the same monotonous tonic. Probably the most extreme example of lacking dissonance and resolution in popular music is this. This song is really nothing more than a rhythmic strumming of two chords throughout the entire song and a rhythmic chanting of a single note in the vocals. Still, this song was and does continue to be exceedingly popular. Now, by no means am I suggesting that this is bad music at all. It's not. What it is that it's very undemanding music. It asks very little of those both listening and playing the songs. That in itself is of value to many people. Some people can only be stimulated at the reptilian level of their brains, and others only wish to be. They find it relaxing, perhaps, and do not want to be intellectually challenged in the way more melodic music would challenge them. Remember, too, such music is good in contexts where the music itself is not the main goal. There are people who listen to music while doing household chores, playing games, even reading, or using the radio as a background to conversation that find the rhythmic monotony keeps them company without distracting their concentration the way that more melodic music would. Another group of people who tend to enjoy this kind of music are amateur musicians who like to meet for jam sessions. Such songs are easy to learn and play, and thus those attending a jam session can find that they can start jamming immediately. This means that it serves a social function. Typically, amateur or even semi-professional musicians who play guitar, bass, or drums cannot read musical notation, and thus cannot simply play a new and more melodic song on the fly simply by placing the music sheet in front of them. For a group of musicians to learn a new and more complex song without the benefit of the notation would become a chore and reasonably defeat the purpose of the jam session in the first place, which is largely social interaction and not an attempt to improve their musical skills. What is so good with classical gas is that the resolution of one phrase or section of the music immediately forms the dissonant stage of the next phrase, right afterward. Aesthetics is an exact science. Perhaps it's time for a bit of a pop quiz. It's time for another musical interlude. I will play a rock and roll blues tune, but this does just barely fit in the criteria for the Aristotelian aesthetic. But now you should know why when listening. If you don't like this song, try to think of why you don't. Does it or does it not stimulate your senses in a way that you want music to do? If you do like this song, would you like it in all contexts, or do you think that there would be times and places that you'd be in the mood for this song and others not? Only you can answer such questions for yourself.
Lost in the desert dry.
If you'd like to get in contact with VSI Radio International to ask any questions, offer any comments, or suggest topics to be covered on future broadcasts, please send an email to feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. VSI Radio International is produced in Sweden exclusively for broadcast on WBCQ, transmitting from Monticello, Maine, USA on 7,490 kHz. My name is Paul Lambert. There's another kind of music that we can touch upon briefly, and that's in the category of what we'd consider catchy. Often a catchy song will have one element that is very much consistent with the Aristotelian aesthetic, but then the rest of the song will fail on these grounds. On the whole, these tend to be fads for some obvious reasons. The catchiness will turn off those people looking only to stimulate their reptilian brains with a simple tune with a good beat, while those who like the catchy little part soon get bored with the song, as the rest of it is unstimulating. Here's an example of such a song from the 80s Swedish hard rock band called Europe. Okay, so that's the neat little part, but then there is hardly any more dissonance and resolution at all, until we get to... We're living together, but still it's farewell, and maybe we'll come back to further contend. I guess there is no one to blame. We're leaving ground. This again. It's the final countdown. And that's about it. We find the same thing in this German synth pop hit. This time, there's a catchy little byline, but then the entire chorus is made up of it, and it gets repetitive. These are the kind of songs we tend to like when we were 16 and then wonder what we were thinking by the time we were 36. No matter how catchy we think they are at one point, we do tend to get bored of them before long. For our next interlude, I'm actually going to play a song from the genre of punk rock. However, this song does fit the criteria of the Aristotelian aesthetic, whereas Johnny Rotten screaming into a stage microphone about anarchy does not. By now, I trust you will appreciate the difference. This song does have a strong beat, which will make it appropriate for some kinds of dancing and will appeal to the Dunka Dunka crowd, but there is a clever melody and chord progression that stimulates the higher senses in the brain. By now, even if you do not like the song, I think you'll appreciate it for what it is.
Stars live in the evening.
I think this lesson can be summed up with a bit of a scientific experiment. I remove some of the variables and allow us to have a bit of a control group. Certainly, one of the most versatile pop groups over the decades has been the Hollies. They cover all the bases, really, and have songs that appeal to the Dunka Dunka crowd, as well as those compliant with the Aristotelian aesthetic. Firstly, let's get a bit of a Dunka Dunka. Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress is one of the more popular songs by the Hollies. By now you can identify the aesthetic qualities of this piece and see what parts of the brain it can stimulate. Same band now, but an extremely different kind of song, one that is compliant with Aristotelian aesthetics. This song was a big hit too. However, notably, those people who like Air That I Breathe will likely not enjoy Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress, and vice versa. They are completely opposite in terms of aesthetics, so it'd be interesting to find if any one song can incorporate elements from both aesthetic trains and appeal to both groups, albeit for different reasons. In this respect, I refer once more to the Hollies. Bus go, she stays, love grows under. Notice here, we have a good beat that will appeal to the Dunka Dunka group, but it has a melody and a chord progression that will keep you on your toes. As well, the lyrics are actually fairly clever, so if you ever have to play a Holly song for a large crowd, Bus Stop will likely be received best. Innovation in music requires a careful inventive use of dissonance and resolution. Simple three-chord songs, sadly, tend to lack dissonance and are thus dull. An opposite peril occurs, however, when there is plenty of dissonance and no resolution. While I certainly recognize his innovation and musical ability, one composer guilty of so much noise creation resulting from being too eager to generate dissonance was the late Russian, then French, then American composer Igor Stravinsky, when he came up with a cacophony like this. A few years later, Stravinsky came up with the following, which was much more controlled and offered more in the way of resolution. While I'm critical of much of Stravinsky's work, I do recognize that he was very innovative and took composition to a new level. Firebird gives the listener a quick moving beat as well as a melody composed of one dissonance and one resolution right after the other. What makes it seem so fast-paced is how one music phrase resolves immediately into a new dissonance, thus producing a cascading effect. As the melody is resolving, the harmony is generating dissonance, and vice versa. We experience such a musical device as being exciting, and it is used prolifically in the scores of many films. American composer John Williams has become almost synonymous with Hollywood films in the past several decades. While I don't doubt his originality, the influences of Stravinsky are abundantly obvious in his own work. In fact, I would contend that Williams is a far better composer than Stravinsky ever was. However, it took Stravinsky to come up with the innovation in musical composition, and then later it took composers greater than him to apply these innovations in a manner that is more aesthetically correct. Keeping in mind the two previous samples from Stravinsky, you can clearly hear his influence in the following piece by John Williams. Yet it took the skill of Williams to turn it into something usable. We'll be right back. Perhaps you've noticed yourself that there's a certain 20-year cycle in the reemergence of music being sold as nostalgic compositions. What I mean is that, for instance, back in the 80s, oldies stations played and special TV offers advertised compilations of the sounds of the 60s. By the 90s, we began seeing music from the 70s emerge and be offered in similar fashion. Of course, the voluminous ABBA Gold and More ABBA Gold collection albums were released in 1993. By the late 90s and into 2000, 80s music saw renewed interest. I think this phenomenon is easy to explain. Quite simply, many of us find that all the music that came out when we were 16 was the best pop music ever written, and nothing before or since can compare. However, when we are 16, we don't have the money to buy all the records we want. By the time we're 36, however, we earn much more money and are finally in the market to buy all the records we could want, and then the market responds accordingly. In many respects, however, our musical tastes can indeed change, and what we did not like in the past suddenly becomes more interesting. I recall very well, as a 15-year-old, first encountering the British band Electric Light Orchestra, which by then had already been an old band. On the radio, you would mostly hear their fast-paced rock songs, and I found them catchy. The particular songs I'm thinking of I still like, but not nearly as much as I did back then. At that time, I decided that I was a bit of a fan, so I went to look for some records of theirs that were typically not played on the radio. As a poor 15-year-old, this confined my search to the local city library. What I found was their 1974 concept album, El Dorado. The music on that album was much different from the fast-paced stuff I heard on the radio, and at first I did have a hard time appreciating it. Today, 21 years later, I appreciate the aesthetics within this rock album more than ever. I think that's a good thing. Just as we learn more and more about other fields as we grow older, the field of aesthetics is something in which we too should become more expert as time goes on. Thus, beyond simply explaining that people's tastes change over time, we should hopefully be able to interpret that as people becoming smarter over time. El Dorado remains a very challenging album and will certainly not be everyone's taste. Still, I'm going to go out on a limb and play one song from that album in its entirety. This is Mr. Kingdom. The melody itself is rather unsophisticated, however the chord progression clearly places this song within the Aristotelian aesthetic, which by now, I hope, you'll be able to discern.
Inside my head.
Once more, if you'd like to contact VSI Radio International to offer comments or questions, or for any other reason, please email me at feedback@vsiradio.org. That's feedback@victorsierraindiaradio.org. It's too simplistic to approve of all the music you like as being good, and all the music you don't like as being bad. If you keep in mind that different people like to be stimulated in different ways, it should be possible at least to appreciate most kinds of music, even those that you might not like yourself. You should be able at least to understand why other people might like it. Remember that music, like anything else, has to be engineered for a certain purpose and to produce a certain effect. Consider, for instance, the difference between a Land Rover and a Rolls-Royce. Both are cars, both can be expensive, but they each serve a much different purpose and appeal to a different kind of buyer. But the buyer of the Rolls-Royce can appreciate why someone in the outback on dirt roads would rather have a Land Rover, and the Land Rover buyer appreciates why a high-flying urbanite would rather put his money into luxury than off-road capabilities. What may be more difficult is articulating to yourself just why you like the music that you do, and why you dislike some other music. It still may be a difficult question to answer, but hopefully by now you will know what to look for when you're considering your musical selections. Thank you for joining me once more on VSI Radio International. Have a pleasant week, and I will be back here the same time next Wednesday. This is Paul Lambert wishing you a good night.
Svarte vego, lige i anne, i form i strøy, det bringer. en hattighet för smått och arg på modern surit. Kom hon där vägen orenbar, tänk vad för medel då hon tar att fina skorna spara. Där fanns ej sten, där fanns ej spång, varpå hon kunde kliva. Gå kring blev vägen allt för lång, ej vill hon smutsig bliva. Då lägger hon de bröden så, att hon på dem kun torrskott gå. Men straffet resan stäckte.
If you've enjoyed this presentation, visit www.justrightmedia.org for more programming that's not right-wing, it's just right.